Welcome to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser with Plucky and Stacy. Hey, if Ben Bernanke were a jazz poet, he and his fellow Beat Central Bank brethren might have said, I went down to the financial collapse caused by many a too big to fail bank. I tried to think, but couldn't, so I jumped in and sank. And so here we are, sunk in a Great Depression. Right, Plucky?
That's right, Max. Right in the Great Depression. Where's Theresa May? Where's Theresa May?
Oh, she's hiking in Switzerland, Plucky.
When's Brexit? When's Brexit?
She has to invoke Article 50.
She's never gonna do it! She's never gonna do it!
Plucky, you're a bad chicken. All right, so what's going on there, Stacy?
Well, you know, Plucky, of course, is a central banker, and he predicted all of the stuff, many of the things that we talk about. It's actually, he's our source. So I want to talk about...
I was right! I was right!
I want to talk about hyperinflation and chaos. And remember, this is an inflation-deflation debate that has raged across the economics and blogosphere for quite a while.
10 years.
And many in the beginning of the financial crash in 2008 said that there would be hyperinflation. Now, when we think of hyperinflation, we think of Venezuela, where people are standing in line for days in order to get a skinny little chicken like that. And here is a headline from the mainstream, which supports exactly what Plucky has told the Kaiser Report audience for years. A Venezuela is happening in capital markets. So in a letter to investors to mark their 10-year anniversary, James Litinsky of JHL Capital wrote that, quote, global central banks have given us another kind of inflation, currently isolated to financial assets. They have printed so much money and so severely manipulated market prices via an extreme floor on bond prices, such that there is a Venezuela happening in the capital markets. Think of it as chaos on the streets for money people who are searching for yield or lining up to find the assets they need. Clearly, a financial asset shortage is not as dire as a real goods shortage like Venezuela. We do not consume our bonds like rice, packaged soup, or toilet paper. Yet it is naive to think that there will not be dramatic long-term societal consequences.
In the financial markets, the global financial markets, are starving for some income, for some yield. And all the bonds have been purchased to the point where the coupon or interest rate is zero. Central banks are pursuing financial oppression, which is the Financial Monetarization Act of transferring money from pensioners and workers to speculators and hedge fund managers. And as a result, you have a drying up. You have a liquidity crisis. In 2008, it flamed out spectacularly in the global financial crisis, which was responded to by global central banks with $20 trillion of fresh capital that they injected into the system. But now all of that money has been wasted on assets or parked offshore or parked through the Panama Papers. We now know there's about $20 to $25 trillion that's not accounted for in the global economy. That's all the money that was printed. It's not circulating. The velocity of money, in fact, is crashing. Just like the velocity of money, just like the velocity of food flowing through Venezuela has come to a grinding halt, the velocity of money flowing through the global economy has come to a grinding halt. And Plucky, by the way, objects to you referring to him as skinny. He's featherly challenged.
You know, just like in Venezuela and now the capital markets, there were a command and control happened over a long period of time, which resulted in this. So, for example, in Venezuela, they import most of their food, almost the entirety of it, partly because of policies that they set in motion a long time ago. They also have their currency pegged, which caused this hyperinflation. In the capital markets, however, even Alan Greenspan in the past week was mentioning that because of these low interest rates, because of the central banks bailing out these bankers all the time, what we see is that collapse in productivity as well. In the outside world, outside of this, what's happening in capital markets is desperation. Most ordinary people are not being told by the mainstream financial news. You know, they're all pointing at Venezuela and laughing at the command and control dictator and all this sort of stuff that look at what they're causing over there. Their people are hungry. Well, they're not pointing and mocking the capital markets of look at what we've done, this Sovietization, this command and control, we try to control the markets and look at the crazy behavior and look at the desperation happening.
Right, and the worst part of this is the trend toward negative interest rates. I want to have Mark Carney, the head of the Bank of England, explain something to me. Just a week ago or 2 weeks ago, he was saying that, well, we're going to slash rates here in the UK from 0.5 point to 25 basis points, a 50% slash in rates. And when asked about negative interest rates, he said, well, no, I don't think that's a very good idea. That never works. It's not sustainable. And then a few days later, the Royal Bank of Scotland has introduced negative interest rates for their biggest, you know, some of their larger commercial customers. They're going to start charging them to park money there. The trend we see around the world is first they go toward these larger banking accounts, commercial accounts. They charge for the funds to be parked at the bank. Then they go after the retail. There's now a bank in Germany that's charging retail customers to park their money at the bank, a negative interest rate, which is wealth confiscation. Now it's in the UK. Now it's all over Europe. It'll be in the US at some point. And that is the result of a Venezuela-like command and control, central bank-led policy geared toward funneling cash toward the kleptocracy and the kakistocracy ruled by the least qualified, out of the workers, out of the savers, financial oppression, financial terrorism, orchestrated by the same nincompoops and running the Bank of England.
Well, if we call Maduro a dictator, then we should certainly call these central bankers dictators. So the other thing I want to point out is that you mentioned at the time on our show, on here on the Kays Report, that when Mark Carney cut rates from 50 basis points to 25 basis points, that's a 50% cut. And I did see the mainstream, sort of non-financial press here, acting in shock that many of the high street banks cut their savings rates by 50%. And they were like, but interest rates were only cut by 25 basis points. Why are they cutting it by their interest that they pay their consumers, their, you know, the depositors, by 50%?
Well, financial illiteracy, unfortunately, rules the high street banks and the economics profession, where they don't understand that to go from a 50% to a 25% is a 50% cut. But they don't seem to understand that the savers have had to underwrite this wealth and income gap and this property bubble. You know, it's all paid for by savers.
Now, this is another Business Insider wrote about this piece about the Venezuela in the capital markets. And now they assess this statement from this hedge fund in a very similar way to what we have done over and over, and in order to explain Brexit, in order to explain Trump, then the mainstream media.
When's Brexit?
Plucky Theresa May has to invoke Article 50 before there is a Brexit. Don't you understand? She has delayed it now. It's a little bit longer than she said it would be. It's never coming. Plucky.
So just by pointing out the obvious and what we have said, we, of course, say that people say that we somehow support this, but we're pointing out the obvious of what happens when central banks become these dictators that cause Venezuela-like a situation in the capital markets. What are these long-term societal consequences, Business Insider asks? Low rates have been in part a monetary solution where a political one was and is more necessary. They are a symptom of the global political class's abdication of responsibility. They help explain why so many people desperately want change. So the global political class abdication of responsibility that includes the Beltway, the sort of bloggers and journalists who are very close to MPs, close to congresspeople, close to DC, close to Downing Street, close to, you know, Whitehall. So those that are close to these power and are in awe of them often, like you see what here in the UK, for example, they totally mock those scumbag voters who support Jeremy Corbyn because they just don't get it. They don't get it. But here we're seeing what is happening is when you have the sort of situation that central bankers have created. These people want change no matter what because there's only a monetary solution. Political solutions are not on offer for the body politic.
Well, Louisiana is flooded, and the economy is suffering because it was too much water. Okay, the global economy is suffering because there's too much central bank printing. You know, they are the analogous to having an out of control flood of money that, just like in Louisiana, that water is not being irrigated. It doesn't go into some farmland. It doesn't go somewhere where they're growing crops or doesn't generate a hydroelectric power. It just sits there and rots and destroys stuff. So when you just interject trillions of dollars into this global economy from the bank without it actually going into work, without it going into productivity, without going into a factory, it just sits there in these stagnant pools of concentrated wealth that rot and fester and create inbred lunatics who then become powerful and run office and then change rules to make it easier to sit on more of this stinking, rotten pool of rat-infested money generated by these kleptocrats and psychopaths. Janet Yellen, Mark Carney, to name two.
Well, you were talking about central bank beat poets. Of course, Alan Greenspan had his own language. He was like a Shakespeare of central bankers. And as I was pointing out, he was interviewed last week and he was talking about these central banks and what they've done. And he mentioned how much productivity has collapsed directly because of how they are giving free money to the bankers. And the bankers are, instead of speculating on bond prices ever being bought up by central banks at an ever higher price. So he's saying that these corporations are also engaged in share buybacks and they're not investing in capital expenditure. So therefore, you're going to have the Venezuela situation go from the capital markets, whereas right now it's contained, into the real economy, because that will happen when there's nothing left to the company. There are no buildings, no desks, no, they haven't invested in anything. They haven't invested in computers. They haven't invested in you know, factory goods, nothing.
Well, yes, you can't escape the battery farm. Essentially, we're all becoming virtual reality plugged into this casino gulag model, which is fed by ever-increasing amount of worthless tokens called currency by central banks, viewing ads for the sake of a few social media companies. So you have nothing left. Plunky escaped a battery farm to become one of the primary central bankers in the world. And he can tell you horror stories about it. It's a horror.
In the last few moments, I want to say Deutsche Bank whistleblower rejects award because SEC went easy on executives. So this is Eric Benartzi. He was a former risk officer. He blew the whistle on basically dodgy, fraudulent derivatives from Deutsche Bank. And he's now rejected his $8 million, his share of the $16 million whistleblower reward. And one of the things he says is basically there's a revolving door. If he looked at all the lawyers for Deutsche Bank, they went to work for the SEC. And now we have, again, this political situation. There's no political answer. There's only monetary answers. Well, Base wary of Clinton Foundation's tied to troubled banks. So here's this guy, from whistleblower from Deutsche Bank. The Central Bankers Act on behalf of Deutsche Bank and all their fraudulent derivatives that blew up and caused, you know, the Venezuela-like situation in capital markets. Deutsche Bank is one of Hillary Clinton's, the Clinton Foundation's biggest supporters. And the information shows, this is from 2015 when the media still looked at Hillary Clinton, and what they found is that Deutsche Bank and Standard Chartered Bank and any of these banks that got in trouble in Europe, as soon as they got in trouble, within weeks, they invested, they donated to the Clinton Foundation. So whether or not there's ever going to be a political solution to the Venezuelan capital markets seems unlikely.
He turned down an $8 million reward?
Yes.
That's not chicken feed. We got to go to the second half, Stacey. Thank you.
Stay tuned for the second half. A whole lot more. Welcome back to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. Venezuela may be happening in the capital markets, but an entire telenovela has been happening in crypto markets this year. Time now to turn to Simon Dixon of BankToTheFuture.com to talk about ongoing drama in the crypto novella market. Simon Dixon, welcome back to the Kaiser Report.
Great to be back.
All righty. So we have so much to cover. There's been so much going on in crypto. But first, let's just mention Kim.com, the celebrated Kim.com, has announced Bitcash. He'll be raising money on your platform, Bank to the Future. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so Kim.com is going back. He's coming back, and he's launching his second version of Mega Upload, which is encrypted file storage. And he's looking at attaching those transactions to Bitcoin payments now, potentially bringing hundreds of thousands. Well, you know, there was apparently 100 million users in the first Mega Upload. So it'll be bringing lots and lots of new people to the Bitcoin market. And he's raising finance for his solution to scale the number of Bitcoin transactions that can happen every second.
And this all started with a 3 a.m. message on the internet between me, you, and him.
Yeah, we got the Twitter direct message from Kim.com, and you've been working with Kim for a while, so.
Yeah.
But there's another drama on that layer, too. But Bitcash itself was a response to a storyline within this crypto novella, and that's the block size. It's quite a racy story, and it involves many big players and drama in a lot of drama. This was the highest drama, most weeping, people threatening, you know, all sorts of horrible stuff if their block size answer wasn't met. So tell us about that block size debate that's been happening over the past few months. We haven't really covered it here, but has it resolved? Has that storyline resolved? And there are several different solutions from the outside, including Bitcash. And then there are some more technical sort of crypto responses. So tell us about the block size debate.
Yeah, so one of the most heated debates was that Bitcoin couldn't scale beyond a certain size. The people that know what they were talking about said that you can only do about 7 transactions per second or so. In order to scale it to the next stage, we need to start implementing changes. On the side, we got this experiment, and many people were calling for what's called a fork. And a fork is where you create another version of the code, and people, the miners that are verifying that code, can decide which one they want, and the one that's most popular becomes Bitcoin. So people were calling for that hard fork, but the developers were being very conservative and saying that there's massive, massive consequences to doing that, and something we don't want to risk because we now have this, at the time, was about a $12-14 billion market cap in Bitcoin. And so what we did is on the side, they implemented some changes that allow it to scale in a very conservative way. Private companies like Blockstream started developing things called the Lightning Network, which is a piece of technology that sits on top of Bitcoin that allows
it to
scale.
So this would be a competitor to Bitcash as well?
Sort of. Well, what Blockstream are doing is they're actually building technology that sits on the actual protocol level, whereas Bitcash is a private company that's implementing a specific solution that kind of centralizes transactions but uses the protocol to get the benefits of both worlds.
So the right now transactions that could happen on Bitcoin, on the blockchain, was 7 per second, compared to, say, roughly what Visa or MasterCard is. How much would that be?
Like
hundreds of thousands per second?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, well, you know, you talk about the hard fork and the consequences. We kind of had a case study, right, with the Ethereum story. What can happen with Ethereum and then Ethereum Classic?
Let's set up the background to that story, because that was, again, Max and I were traveling across the U.S., and there was, like, remarkable, again, it fits with the crypto novella thing, huge crimes. Like, huge crimes always happen on, like, Coronation Street or EastEnders or any of these sort of, you know, British telenovelas. So the huge crimes were massive robberies, you could call them. One for Bitfinex, which was a Hong Kong-based company. We'll come to that second. But as Max brought up Ethereum is a currency, a blockchain, and Ether is their currency. And then there's the DAO, which is a smart contract that wasn't smart enough to avoid being 52 million siphoned from there, 70 million from Bitfinex. But start off with the first robbery, which was from the DAO.
Yeah, so probably some jargon busting to do first.
Yeah.
A smart contract is simply, it's built upon a principle that the founders of Ethereum and others before that came up with, which is that code is law. And so what they tried to do is implement contracts where there's the outcomes of those contracts can be enforced by code rather than law. So if me and you have a bet and there's a specific outcome, then you could say the money goes to you if you're right and the money goes to me if you're wrong. And there's no counterparty there, there's no third party in order to arbitrate that process.
There's no pleading to a judge to accept your side of the story. It's the code is the law.
Exactly. So Ethereum came along and said, we've got a new paradigm for the world. We've got a new blockchain. We're going to use the principles of Bitcoin. We're going to solve all the problems with Bitcoin. And we're going to implement this smart contract system called the code is law. They successfully created the second blockchain that reached $1 billion a market cap.
That was for Ethereum.
For Ethereum.
Yeah.
And they successfully got miners behind it to a point where it was a fairly secure blockchain. Not as secure as Bitcoin, but a fairly secure one, where others had failed. And then the first application came along, which actually was a bit controversial because the foundation behind Ethereum, who were meant to be in charge of the code, started forking off to their own projects and building companies. One of them was a company called Slockit, which was trying to create a smart contract of the Uber model. And then rather than raising finance for Slockit, the team created this incredibly complex structure that was called the DAO.
DAO, so Decentralized Autonomous Organization.
Yeah. Not to confuse with the DAO Jones, DAO.
Or the DAO.
the DAO. And this this essentially was, it was like a VC fund whereby all of the people that contributed to this smart contract were actually the equivalent of the shareholders, and they vote on how the money's spent. And, you know, it was not clear how, you know, they were raising finance for that company, but then they created this DAO, and I think a lot of the money was going to go to that company.
So it's like a venture capital firm, but they raised $150 million?
Well, it was way more successful than anyone ever imagined.
Everybody expected like $1 or $2 million.
It became like an IPO,
yeah.
$150 million worth of this Ether token.
And the notion was that it was supposed to be the wisdom of the crowd knew better than many VC funds are in San Francisco or Silicon Valley, and these one guy knows what's a good bet or not.
That was a theory. And then also the very important theory was that the code is law.
Yes.
So the code is law means that whatever was written into that smart contract was law. And so a very, you know, a hacker, whatever you want to call them, saw a flaw in the code of this DAO that allowed them to drain approximately...
Well, you call it a flaw. He would maybe, or she, or they might have called it, well, that was a brilliantly written contract for me to make a lot of money.
Well, exactly. And so they drained $60 million worth of these smart contracts out of the DAO. And then suddenly we started to get this user case of, can we really test that code is law?
But the way the DAO was set up as well is like you couldn't just withdraw it overnight like you could, say, if you hacked Mt. Gox. It takes 30 days before you could actually get your, or 28 days before you could actually take the,
yeah, so the hacker came out and said, I will legally enforce if you try and take my contracts that I legally got hold of. And the Ethereum Foundation started to realize this is actually might be some kind of systemic risk in our blockchain. And they took a side because, you know, allegedly many people say that a lot of the Ethereum Foundation investors were also the big investors in the DAO.
So when you say that, that's like the equivalent of the Bitcoin Foundation or the biggest Bitcoin holders deciding, for example, Mt. Gox, which is not part of them, but used Bitcoin, and people had $700 million worth of Bitcoin essentially stolen, and that they would have rescued it, like hard fork there to make those. So that's the equivalent of what happened.
Absolutely. And what it did highlight is that some of the principles that made Bitcoin work, i.e. there is no founder and no one knows who Satoshi Nakamoto is, meant that when, you know, large-scale theft happened, like Mt. Gox, no one could go to Satoshi Nakamoto and say, please reverse the chain. But Ethereum was a clear, the people that created it were known. So everybody demanded of these people, I want my money back.
Vitalik Buterin, right?
Yep, so Vitalik, everyone went to Vitalik and the foundation members and said, we demand our money back. Please, can you fork, reverse the chain, do something to get this $60 million and implement something that says the code is not law?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is then a fantastic highlights why Satoshi Nakamoto being anonymous was a genius move, because you can't go retroactively and rewrite history, as it were, number one. Number two, the fact they'd opened up now two chains in the Ethereum. You got the Ethereum Classic and this new Ethereum, the new Ethereum. And so now these two are competing with each other, and you've got...
Ethereum Classic is actually the old one, which became the new one.
Right, it's the old one.
It's like these characters who die on a telenovela and then come back.
So Ethereum Classic is the code is law. That was their principle, which was the original chain. And then the second chain, Ether, is, you know, this one where they reversed and it wasn't immutable. And under extreme circumstance, you can break the contract.
Right. So the thought when it broke, when it hard forked, was that, well, the classic will just kind of die off. because this is now the new one is the main chain, but that hasn't happened, right?
No, I mean, it didn't have a name. You know, they were the Ethereum Foundation was celebrating a successful fork, and they were getting ready for the next phase of Ethereum after this success. And then suddenly this bogey called Ethereum Classic came along, which was created by one of the exchanges, essentially finding some kind of way of issuing all of the investors a new coin. Everybody got their DAO money back. Ether came back, they exchanged it for Ethers, and then this new token came along and everyone doubled up their money, and suddenly all the investors were compensated in a way, but you had this complete split in the community between the code is law and the chain where the code is not law.
All right, well, we're going to have to continue this a little bit because it's a very involved story, interesting story in the crypto
world. Of
course,
all telenovelas need a second part, so you got to come back.
You need a cliffhanger.
This is a cliffhanger.
That's a cliffhanger. We'll pick this up in due time. But that's going to do it for this episode of the Kaiser Report with me, Max Kaiser, and Stacey Herbert. I'd like to thank our guest, Simon Dixon of BankToTheFuture.com. If you'd like to get in touch, tweet us at Kaiser Report. Until next time, aye, y'all.